to VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Faith Perlow, and Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Taiwanese puppeteers are bringing their traditional art form into modern times by using non-fungible tokens, or NFTs. An NFT can be attached to a piece of digital artwork. The NFT can be used to provide proof that the pieces are real. The prices of some NFTs rose so fast last year that buyers around the world sometimes resold them within days of purchase for a profit. Pili International Multimedia makes Taiwan's longest-running television show featuring the puppets. The company says it wants to use NFTs as another way to make money. Seika Wang is Pili's brand director. The sort of imagination everyone nowadays has for the online world is developing so fast that we are almost unable to grasp it, Wang said. Instead of sitting on the sidelines, the best approach is to go ahead and understand fully what's going on. This is the fastest way to catch up. Sitting on the sidelines is an expression that means to be inactive and watch as something happens. Pili has thousands of puppet characters, a traditional part of Taiwanese street entertainment culture. The puppets are carefully created and expertly moved around during the filming of shows. The puppets wear colorful clothes. They are used to tell stories of courage and romance. Many of these stories involve the martial arts. Pili said 4 of their puppet characters were made into digital copies, and 30,000 sets have been sold as NFTs. The company said prices for each set started at $40, creating at least $1.2 million in earnings since their listing in early February. The company did not say how much of that money was shared with the marketing company that supervises the selling of the NFTs. Vivi, the marketing company that sells the NFTs, said the stories of the puppet heroes are popular with young people. The company added that the NFTs could draw in foreign fans of superhero films, such as those based on characters from Marvel Comics. Westerners actually really like our martial arts heroes and kung fu, said Vivi's brand manager, Raymond Chu. Kung fu is a traditional Chinese form of self-defense, a martial art. Wang said their first listings had sold out seconds after launching on Vivi. The company is now working on turning up to 50 other puppet characters into NFTs, possibly providing millions of dollars for the studio. I'm John Russell.
Bangladesh, the southwest seaport town of Mongla, is home to thousands of refugees. They are not fleeing war or another conflict. They are refugees from climate change. Munira Khatun is 29 years old and is one of these refugees. She returned to her father's home after her husband left her, only to have her father die. She had to care for three other family members. A river washed away her family's home. I lost everything. There was darkness all around. My parents' home was gone to the river for erosion. We had no land to cultivate, Khatun said. She moved to Mangla and now works in a factory in a special economic zone that gives jobs to climate refugees. There are about 150,000 climate refugees in Mangla. They have lost their homes, land, and work. Most are from nearby villages. Now there is a chance at a new life in the coastal town near the Bay of Bengal. A United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published a report stating that by 2050, 143 million people will be forced to move because of climate change. They will move either within their country's borders or beyond because of rising sea levels, droughts, hot temperatures, and other climate disasters. Asia is one of the hardest hit places, and its leaders are trying to find answers. Mangla is now a model town of climate resilience. Selimul Huck is a climate scientist and the director for the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Dhaka, Bangladesh. He says Mangla's success story is a model for how climate refugees can change their lives through new opportunities. Mangla has offered new opportunities to them, with its seaport and an export processing zone and climate-resilient infrastructure. Mangla Town has become a different story, Huck said. With such a successful model, more towns along the coast in Bangladesh could become migrant-friendly locations. These river and seaport towns are economic centers, and the model could be copied in those places. Huck says that talks have started with leaders of six towns so far. These are all secondary towns with populations of up to 500,000, which can shelter up to another 500,000 climate migrants each. Thus, we can offer alternatives to at least 10 million climate migrants over the next one decade, Huck said. Bangladesh is vulnerable to the effects of climate change because it is near sea level. Millions are at risk of being forced to leave their homes just in Bangladesh because of river erosion, increased movement of salt water, and intense storms. The World Bank reported in 2021 that by the year 2050, Bangladesh will have half of the estimated number of refugees in all of South Asia, a total of almost 19 million displaced people. The idea of creating new communities for the displaced is called transformative adaptation. It is an alternative to forcing the climate refugees to move into the poorer areas of larger cities, like in the capital of Dhaka. 24 smaller coastal towns, like Mangla, could accept 10 million refugees minimum. The trend is that climate migrants move to places where there are economic activities for them. We can't stop displacement. We can only offer alternatives that they will accept, he said. Small changes in Bangladesh have occurred in recent years, like rice that is able to grow in salt water. These changes have helped some communities manage the effects of climate change, but Huck says that these changes are not long-term. Transformative adaptation is the best solution. The government of Bangladesh is protecting the town of Mangla by spending tens of thousands of dollars creating climate-resilient infrastructure. Foreign investments from countries like the United States, Japan, South Korea, and China have increased over the past 4 years. These investments in the Mangla Export Processing Zone have created new factory jobs for the climate refugees. I'm Faith Perlow.
Young people all over the world are seriously concerned about the state of politics and education. That information comes from a survey by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. The study looked at 151 youth organizations from 72 countries. It centered on young people aged 15 to 29. The researchers noted that people between those ages have lived through two worldwide crises, the 2008 financial collapse and the coronavirus pandemic. OECD researchers say it is important to learn the effects of the pandemic on younger people. The pandemic, they said, has affected different age groups differently, and its repercussions will be felt by many for decades to come. Youth organizations were asked to identify three areas in which young people were finding it most difficult to deal with the effects of COVID-19. The top answers were mental health, education, and employment. Other areas of concern were personal relationships, personal wealth, and limits on individual freedom. The researchers said the pandemic's long-term effects on education remain to be fully observed. The study added that the crisis has greatly reduced international student mobility, widened educational differences across different populations, and increased the risk of students ending their education. An OECD study released this year found that, on average, 6% of 15 to 19-year-olds in OECD countries were not involved in employment, education, or job training in 2020. In poorer countries like Colombia and Brazil, at least 20% of young people were not involved in employment, education, or training. The effects of the crisis have been more severe, the study said, for young women, young people from socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds, young people not in employment, education, or training, and other young people in vulnerable circumstances, the study said. Several countries have increased educational spending and sought to improve the lives of vulnerable groups. Canada's government, for example, provided money to help Native groups complete secondary school. The country also introduced more child care support for young women in an effort to close the wage difference between men and women. Sweden extended the time for which young immigrants studying in upper secondary education must find a job after graduation from 6 to 12 months. There, immigrants are required to have a job upon graduation to get residency. France, Belgium, and Estonia have started new programs and trainings for young people out of education and the workforce to build new skills. Overall, just 3 out of 32 OECD member countries studied by the researchers, Iceland, Japan, and Luxembourg, did not target young people as part of their recovery plans. Even with such efforts, young people's trust in government has decreased since the pandemic started. Of all countries taking part in the study, 37% of youth organizations say their trust in government has decreased. They also reported low levels of approval for government services like health care, housing, and education. 34% of youth organizations surveyed also say they are less satisfied with democracy. Many countries looked to build trust with young people by partnering with youth organizations in planning recovery measures. Australia invited youth organizations to comment on the government's budget goals. Estonia listed the National Youth Council as an important partner in the creation of its recovery plan. Mexico questioned 20,000 of its young citizens on issues like education, employment, health, and violence to inform policy measures. When governments communicate proactively, the researchers said, they can generate citizen buy-in and engagement, including among young people. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Begin this story on January 20th, 1961, the day John Fitzgerald Kennedy became President of the United States. It had snowed heavily the night before. Few cars were in the streets of Washington. The outgoing president, Dwight Eisenhower, was 70 years old. John Kennedy was just 43. He was the first American president born in the 20th century. Both Eisenhower and Kennedy served in World War II. Eisenhower had been commander of Allied forces in Europe. Kennedy had been a young Navy officer in the Pacific. He came from a politically influential family in Boston, Massachusetts. But he was a fresh face in national politics. To millions of Americans, he represented a chance for a new beginning. Not everyone liked him, however. Many people thought he was too young to be president. Others did not like the idea of electing the nation's first Roman Catholic president. Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, ran against Kennedy in the election of 1960. Many people believed Nixon was a stronger opponent of communism than Kennedy. The election of 1960 was one of the closest in American history. Kennedy defeated Nixon by fewer than 120,000 votes. Now, on the steps of the Capitol building, he would be sworn in as the nation's 35th president. One of the speakers at the inauguration was the 86-year-old poet Robert Frost. The wind was blowing the paper in his hands, and the sun was shining off the snow on the ground and into his eyes. Kennedy stood to help him, but the famous poet was unable to read much of the poem he had written specially for the ceremony. Instead, he began another one that he knew from memory. Here is a studio recording of Robert Frost reading his poem, The Gift Outright.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's. Still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war. To the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become.
Soon it was time for the new president to speak. He was not wearing a winter coat or a hat, unlike many of the people around him. One of the issues that Kennedy talked about was the danger of what he called the deadly atom. He was taking office during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. Both sides had atomic bombs. People worried that there could be a World War III that would end in nuclear destruction. Kennedy said, both sides should make serious proposals for the inspection and control of nuclear weapons. He said they should explore the good in science instead of the terrors.
Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just, and the weak secure, and the peace preserved.
Kennedy also spoke about a torch of leadership being passed to a new generation of Americans. He urged young people to take the torch and accept responsibility for the future. He also urged other countries to work with the United States to create a better world.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
John Kennedy was in office less than 2 weeks when the Soviet Union released two American airmen. The Soviets had shot down their spy plane over the Bering Sea. About 60 million people watched as Kennedy announced the airmen's release. It was the first presidential news conference broadcast live on television in the United States. Kennedy welcomed the release as a step toward better relations with the Soviet Union. The next month, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev made another move toward better relations. He sent Kennedy a message. The message said that disarmament would be a great joy for all people on Earth. A few weeks later, President Kennedy announced the creation of the Peace Corps. He had spoken about his idea during the election campaign. The Peace Corps would send thousands of Americans to developing countries to teach and provide technical assistance. Soon after the Peace Corps was created, another program was announced. The purpose of the Alliance for Progress was to provide economic aid for 10 years to nations in Latin America. Another subject that Kennedy had talked about during the election campaign was the space program. He believed the United States should continue to explore outer space. The Soviet Union had gotten there first. It launched the world's first satellite in 1957. Then, in April 1961, the Soviet Union sent the first manned spacecraft into orbit around Earth. That same month, the new American president suffered a foreign policy failure. On April 17th, more than 1,000 Cuban exiles landed on a beach in western Cuba. They had received training and equipment from the United States Central Intelligence Agency. They were supposed to lead a revolution to overthrow the communist government of Fidel Castro. The place where they landed was Bahia de Cochinos, the Bay of Pigs. The invasion failed. Most of the exiles were killed or captured. It was not Kennedy's idea to try to start a revolution in Cuba. Officials in the last administration of Dwight Eisenhower had planned it. However, most of Kennedy's advisors supported the idea, and he approved it. In public, the president said he was responsible for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. In private, he said, "All my life, I've known better than to depend on the experts. How could I have been so stupid?" What happened in Cuba damaged John Kennedy's popularity. His next months in office would be a struggle to regain the support of the people.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.